Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to chumbacasino.com.
Chumbacasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dreek.
Well, at least with Robin Dreek. So anyway, welcome to Hidden Killers Live. I'm Robin Dreek, filling the big chair while Tony's away on his honeymoon, but back tomorrow. Anyway, glad you're with us. Today, we're taking your questions, and joining me today is the man who makes it all work for us every day, our producer and wingman, Todd Michaels, as well as our chief of our news desk, Lisa Hale. So with that, we're going to dive right into your questions. So let's just start out with Nancy Guthrie once again, because we got some big questions in here. Anyway, we're at 6 months in and the Nancy Guthrie case still refuses to sit still. Blood on a porch, a masked man on a doorbell camera, ransom notes that turned out to be fake, except for the ones the FBI still won't rule out. Savannah Guthrie has spent half a year doing the thing no one should have to do, and that is grieving in public while still holding out hope. And the people writing in aren't asking about court dates. They're asking the question everyone's been chewing on since February. How does an 84-year-old woman just vanish from her own home in the middle of the night? And 6 months later, law enforcement still can't tell us if she's the victim of a kidnapping or murder or something they haven't even named yet. Joining me again, as I said, is Todd Michaels and our amazing Lisa Hale. So what do you all think of where we're starting today?
Lisa, I'm going to let you go first.
Oh, great. I get to go first. The new best. So when you're looking at 6 months out, the problem that I have with this entire case isn't so much that we haven't found Nancy yet, because there are so many missing people that we just have not found yet. But because of Nancy's connection to celebrity, we've been paying more attention to this case. And I think that's the hardest thing to talk about, is how this is affecting Savannah, because she has to go in, just pretend none of this is bothering her every morning, every day, doing her job. So that's what I'm more worried about. I know eventually, even if we don't find Nancy, this case is going to drop out of the media.
The cycle?
Yeah, the cycle. The focus. And it's going to drop out, but it's still going to be with Savannah for the rest of her life, no matter what happens. And that going on and acting like nothing is happening is the hardest thing, and something that some of us who've been in broadcast can relate to.
Yeah, she's got to definitely maintain that professionalism that she does every day. And she has reps at doing this. And so it's a challenge and a struggle, but I don't think it's something that she's unfamiliar with, because, I mean, you and you two have been in broadcasting a long time. Sorry, I didn't mean to emphasize long time. but you know, you've covered stories that are heart-wrenching, that bring you to tears, but you still got to maintain that professionalism to keep carrying on. And so I think that's what she's relying on, is that, you know, you can disassociate to a certain degree because you have to, and she does have the reps of doing that, so she can be the professional that the audience hopes that she can be and expecting her to be. But at the same time, though, you know, she is grieving and working through the process. But, you know, Lisa, to your point, like, thousands upon thousands of people in this country, I was about to pull up the stat on it, I've done it before, but how many people aren't being covered because they're not married to a celebrity, or, you know, as we've covered in so many other cases, they're not the good looking white girl that vanishes. And so they get covered and others don't. So that is part of the news cycle. But I also think that part of this news cycle is yes, it's Savannah. Yes, it's her mom, the unusual situation, and of that unto itself, but also Pima County isn't helping it as well. You know, so I think that the sheriff has become part of the news cycle as well, unfortunately. And the first question that was asked, it's a challenging one, but I think it's one I wanted to ask. And that is, where's Nancy Guthrie?
Well, Robin, I mean, if you had to take that question yourself, where do you think she is?
I don't think she's with us. I don't think she's been with us for a very long time. I think that she was gone pretty early on. I think that because of the first two notes that I'm going to use the language the FBI did. Hopefully I got the wording exactly right. And that is they're treating the first two notes as if they're the legit ones. And they're treating this case as if it was an abduction and kidnapping case. And that wording suggests to me that they're not locked into that. They're just treating it as if, meaning I still think that whoever did this, porch guy, and or if they had an accomplice or not, the intent was to go into this house, grab something, whether it was Nancy or something else, and profit from that gain. Along the way, a critical health issue happened, and she died as a result of either a struggle, heart attack, something that she deceased, whether she deceased inside that house during that or afterwards after they took her away from that house. That's what remains to be seen. But as a result of that, I would think that if there was an ability to return her, they would have returned her or left a place for her to go, especially if you were to believe the second note that was received that they're treating as if it was a legit note and that just expressing the regret that she died. I know I'm paraphrasing that. So you have a certain level of empathy in that note. So if there was an ability to return a body in some way that they thought would be good, you think they'd leave instructions, direction? I don't know. So I think that she is unfortunately in a place in the middle of the desert somewhere.
I tend to agree with you on that. And kind of going back to what Lisa was saying about the news cycle, I think this case has brought to light and others as well. But this one, because of the celebrity connection that is with Savannah, I feel that this really puts to light some inadequacies in some law enforcement institutions in our country and the way things are handled. And I think a lot of us who have followed this case are learning very quickly the difference between local authorities and the FBI, how they work together. I mean, it's really been a masterclass for me learning how this all works together. Who's in charge? Who can do this? Who can't do that? Who has to ask for something else before it's done? You know, where some of the DNA was sent, all that kind of stuff. It's been very eye-opening to me. My biggest concern here, though, is going back to the number of people on a yearly basis that go missing and we just never hear about them and we never find them again. So it's an unfortunate situation. I think there's a lot to learn about how law enforcement works and maybe in some cases how it's not working, but also it does shed a light on missing individuals. So maybe this will spur some interest in looking into some of these other cases that are out there as well.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm going to look up that number again so we have a good stat on it. But Todd, you really emphasize something really important on this, and that is what you learned about how law enforcement operates, doesn't operate together, collaborate. I remember after 9/11 in New York, everyone was criticizing the Bureau and our lack of cooperation with CIA and sharing intelligence across all these different communities. And I remember for me, it was really befuddling to hear all that. And why? Well, because I had great, strong, healthy working relationships with everyone. And what I saw throughout my career was that those relationships and dialogues are so critical at every single level, but they're not institutional. You hope they're institutional. But a lot of times they're very, very individual. They come down to the people on the street executing and how well they're getting along. I got along exceptionally well with all our intelligence partners in New York City, whether it's CIA, MI5, MI6, you know, the British equivalents of 007s, the Canadians, the Australians, the New Zealanders, the Five Eyes, as they call. it all came down to those relationships. Matter of fact, it is such a force multiplier for law enforcement. That's why we have task force in the Bureau, because a task force brings together all the elements of state, local, and federal on a task force, so that when a mishap or some tragedy like this happens, you have all these different resources, already have relationships, you know who can call on what resources are here, you know who can do the interviews here without a subpoena, or that they need a subpoena, who's got, you know, so you're able to really bring all these resources together because it's already pre-established relationships. Across the FBI, you have both the field office, the main field offices, which is 56 across the country, that represent the main hub in every state. And then you also have, out of those 56 field offices, you have resident agencies. And each one of those resident agencies are dispersed amongst their territories, you know, so the small little satellite offices. And the main job of the position called the SSRA, Supervisory Special Agent of the Resident Agency, they're the ones in charge. Their number one job is liaison with local law enforcement. And so, I mean, in the last office I served in, there was an instance where someone, an SSRA was removed because they were not able to maintain the relationships they needed to maintain. So they moved them. It's very, very critical, very important.
There's a question that I found very interesting online. It's from Denise on Facebook, and she said that her mother is 84 years old too, and she lives alone. The case has genuinely changed how I think about her front door. Should it? I mean, Robin, let's get your perspective on that. Is this something we should all be worrying about, or just because it's in our face now, it's a top mind for us?
I think it's, you know, and I'll get personal on this one too. I think these things are always important for us to maintain a healthy regard for life and mortality. And I say mortality because I shared with you guys last week, you know, my dad is 82 and just had a really bad fall, and he was in a hospital. He just finally made it home. Very, very bad condition. And whether it's the front door camera or having a first alert on you, because he was home alone when he fell and he was immobile. I mean, it could have gone even much worse than it was. I think it's really incumbent upon everyone, because my son lives alone and he's a Marine Corps officer. You know, I'm always worried about him. You know, I would always make sure, especially since we have the technology today, to be able to really cover our bases, to be able to maintain and monitor the friends and family and those we care deeply about. If you have the ability to do it, do it. Now, should you be super paranoid about it? No, but what we do in life every day, and it's how I do my behavioral assessments, is we look for wobbles in normal. But if you establish a normal with, say, you know, in this case, you know, she has an elderly mother, should I be worried about these things? No, you don't need to be paranoid, but what you need to do is set up a pattern of behavior where you have a reasonable expectation of what kind of communication and what kind of tempo of communication you're going to maintain with the people you love in your life. And it should be, if you have good, healthy relationships, at least a couple times a week, if they're elderly or if they're single or something like that, maybe you want to check in once a day. For example, in our family, we have a group chat that we're all on, and we say good night and good morning to everyone. Call us nuts, call us over sentimental, but we do. We check in.
I'm going to call you the Waltons, is what I'm going to call
you.
Yeah,
it is. Good night, Jim Bob. Yeah, I know. Well, not that Jim Bob, you know, because I would.
Right, not the Duggar Jim Bob.
Not IBLP. No, none of that. But what it does is now when there's a deviation from the wobble, now there's some concern. And so here's a great example. I had been, when my dad got hospitalized, I was checking in pretty frequently, seeing how things are going. I didn't do the trip up because I'm trying to do my behavioral assessments. I'm gauging tempo. I'm gauging reactions. I'm gauging language being used by my mother. And then what happened was when they actually got home, I was getting not as fast responses. And so I got a wobble, and I'm like, uh-oh. And I came down to the fact that I was going to give it another 2 hours before I actually upped my communication. and that's going to do a little bit of a deeper dive. And so what we want to do, and again, I give these long narrative answers, for everyone listening that has someone you're concerned about in life, they're single, they're elderly, or there's some sort of issue, make sure you have, and we all do, just be aware of it. You have a pattern of regularly accepted communication behavior. That way, if there's a wobble, just don't ignore it. Test it. Do something about it. In other words, if you are expecting to get a response from a loved one, give it a little bit of reasonable time, but then dive deeper. Call a neighbor. Escalate. And say, if it's going to be a text, make a phone call. If you're not doing it, then just do a sign of life call. I mean, one of the things I realized during this entire thing too is local volunteer fire department can do an awful lot, especially if they're sitting around not doing anything. You know, it's like they can help people in and out. They can do a sign, you know, a quality of life, sign of life, whatever. In other words, call someone, do something, but you can only know that there's a problem if you establish that pattern.
Good answer, actually. Very good answer.
Thanks.
And I think that's something that people tend to forget most of the time, is that those average patterns, those patterns of your family, are what you need to remember going forward. Because as you said, those little wobbles, those aberrations, I could send a reel to my sister 475 times. I'm not going to get a response. But
that's a pattern. See, it's a pattern.
That's the pattern. If she starts responding, then I'm going to get a little worried as to what's going on. But I mean, it's just, you establish that pattern and you know, Lisa's going to send me reels. If she stops sending me reels, something's wrong with Lisa. No, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. There's no good patterns, bad patterns, right patterns, or all patterns. It's just patterns. Just understand what that pattern is. And I just pulled up some stats for us while you were talking, Lisa. Total elderly reported missing a year, between 100 and 120,000.
Wow.
But that includes not abductions like this, but that's all cases. Now, suspicious, unexpected, unexplained disappearances, between 8,000 and 12,000, where possible foul play is suspected. Stranger abduction or home invasion style, 400 to 700. Elderly homicide with body not immediately found, 150 to 250 per year.
We had a question, and I just want to clarify this. The question was, how do we know that Nancy's family didn't have a system for how they checked on Nancy?
Right.
We weren't necessarily speaking about this case or Nancy's family. We were just saying, in general, what can we do on a daily basis in our lives to make sure that those around us are protected?
Yeah, because I tell you, we don't know. And I'm actually going to establish a pattern behavior that they did have that alerted people right away. So from what we know on social media and reporting, one of the patterns of behavior was that Nancy would go out to dinner with her son-in-law and daughter every Saturday, and they would a lot of times play cards afterwards. All right, so that's the pattern behavior. And the next day she would do church, whether in person or virtually. What happened? There was a deviation. She didn't show up for that pattern behavior, and she's reported. So, I mean, granted, it wasn't that night, but it's pretty soon after. So, in other words, it wasn't that she was sitting at home and people didn't miss her for like a week or two. I mean, how long did it take Gene Hackman's family? And again, this is not a criticism, but they sat there for quite a while because there might not have been a usual pattern of behavior that they deviated from. So that's why I really think the Guthries, they did have a pattern behavior. And that's just what we knew about in social media. We didn't know even deeper than that. Maybe Savannah reached out daily to check in on mom. So there's a lot of things. That's how we are alerted to these things earlier rather than later.
Let's hit one more question. So there's blood on the porch. This is from Tom on YouTube. He says, there's blood on the porch. The FBI is still calling this a kidnapping for ransom case. Feels like they're protecting a theory instead of chasing the evidence. Am I wrong? Robin, let's start with you.
I don't think they're protecting anything. I asked this of Jennifer Coffendeffer last Friday. I'm not completely sold like on the 80% side that this was targeted abduction. I think it was targeted for profit in some way and it went sideways. I don't think they're hiding anything. Whenever you do an investigation, you have to label it a type of investigation in order to move forward. You have to open a file because it gets classification. And that's why they're using as if it was a targeted abduction. It doesn't change anything. That my question to Jennifer was, does it change the investigative tools they have at their disposal? No, but it might change a level of cooperation they get, might change a level of attention it gets. And so they're going to label it and classify it as a certain thing at the get-go for resources, for collaboration, for statistics, believe it or not. But I don't think they're hiding anything, believe me, because I would think we'd have different leakage. I mean, the fact that we even have leakage from the FBI, supposedly, you know, through Reuters, that they don't believe any of the letters were actually legit letters, the ransom letters or the extortion letters, because Jennifer broke them down between ransom and extortion letters. If there was a different classification or reason of what that was going on, I think we would have had more leakage on that as well.
One of the things that I wanted to mention about the leakage is that I think we as Americans, we're so immersed in procedural drama when it comes to our television watching and the things that we pick up on. And I think what Nancy's case is also showing us is that our way of picturing how law enforcement works and works together is absolutely fictional because of all this stuff that we've been handed. And, you know, we expect it to be as quick as we see it on TV. The murder happened, they get the DNA back, make an arrest, da-da. But it's not like that. And that's why some of this is so drawn out. It's just not like that.
It's not a 60-minute serial TV show is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We can't solve a case in 60 minutes. We can't solve
it. Dang it. Why not? Why can't we get that done?
It's not going to happen. It's not going to get solved in a week.
It's too funny like that, isn't it? But yeah, it's, I'm always amazed. Probably the most common questions I get from everyone all the time is, you know, how much like Criminal Minds is what you do every day? And dude, it's nothing like that. real life. Actually, probably my, it's eye-opening to everyone to kind of see this. And we typically cover the cases that things go sideways on, but everyone always has this expectation. Again, this is that Criminal Minds effect and the movie effect that people have when looking at true crime stuff is you expect it to go like you see in the movies. It's never, ever like that. Not just with the tools and technology and speed of the cases, but the relationships. We're not just when we're solving these cases, examining these cases, it's not just the relationships of the victim and the victim's families and those people involved. When I first do my deep dives of these cases, I'm looking at them first, but I'm also analyzing the team investigating as well, because that's going to be very telling. I mean, we've seen this so often on our show, whether it's the Koberger case, you know, it got some criticism early on, but I saw how the local law enforcement in Moscow, Idaho was really doing a great job with the local university. And I saw the relationship between them and the kids and the ability of the kids to want to communicate with law enforcement. I said, well, there's a healthy relationship that law enforcement has. This is going to go decently enough because of that. Then you see things going sideways in other investigations, whether it's a Guthrie case, or, I mean, you pick it, Delphi. I mean, there's a human element that exists everywhere, not just in the bad guys, but in the people covering it. I mean, you know, just look at the law enforcement of their conduct during Boston. You know, that is just abhorrent what was going on in that case. You know who I'm talking about. What's her face? With Proctor and that whole group up there.
Oh yeah, I can't think of her name either.
I know. I tend to block that out of my mind. But yes, but yes, State Trooper Proctor and that whole group. You know, so that's another one. And then you also have Ellen also up there. You know,
the Greenberg,
Ellen Greenberg, Greenberg. Ellen, yep. Greenberg, another one. So these things also they're so interpersonally connected. Anyway. Great questions, great discussions on that. Anyway, your thoughts and questions in the comment section of Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and I've been weighing in even more on these things since Tony's been out. Anyway, the links are in the description. So let's move on to Nick Reiner case. And this one does hit differently because everybody thought they knew the ending before the story even started. Rob Reiner spent 5 decades making America laugh and think, and then he and his wife, Michelle, were found stabbed to death in their own Brentwood home, with their own son under arrest before the sun even came up. Since then, it's been 9 months of continuances, a defense attorney who bailed out for reasons nobody's allowed to say, although I think we all kind of knew, and now a preliminary hearing pushed all the way to September while both sides wade through terabytes of evidence the people writing in aren't asking about court dates either. They're asking the one question that's impossible to shake, and that is, how do you go from Meathead and Princess Bride to your own child accused of ending your life, and can anyone have seen it coming? Your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think we were all surprised to hear the news that night. I was not aware, you know, I was a fan of Rob Reiner, liked him on All in the Family, loved a lot of his movies.
Got my goosebumps. Yeah, me too.
thought the guy was a genius when it came to creating art in that way, shape, or form. Didn't know a lot about the family, and certainly didn't know that Nick was around and had the struggles that he had throughout life with substance abuse and some other things, some mental illness and all that kind of stuff. So when it happened, I was very surprised that it happened. One of the questions we have is, you know, how young was he when he was throwing temper tantrums and things like that? I personally have not seen any information that would necessarily guarantee an exact answer on that. I don't know if either one of you have. Yeah. But it's a very sad story. And again, I was not aware of who Nick Reiner was until this all happened.
Yeah. The research I showed and I did on it was, again, this is just reported from colleagues, friends, family. And to your point, too, you know, we're not going to see these things, but their social group, they're involved with a lot of clubs, groups, organizations where they were at. Again, just being in, I think, in the social end of Hollywood that they were, there was knowns and unknowns. So I don't think he, especially when they made a movie together, a special, it's not like he was hiding his son or hiding his family. So I think they were seeing a lot, because what I saw here from my research was at around the age 11 and before, family and friends and insiders, as again, take that with a grain of salt sometimes, they were seen very young age, terrifying tantrums and violent outbursts from a very young age. So, when we're looking at patterns of behavior and life arcs, as I talk about, the first thing I'm looking for is this an enigma? Is this a spike out of the norm of what we saw or what other people were seeing over a period of time, or wasn't it? And from everything we're seeing, from what was reported, and even, you know, the night of the horrendous murders themselves, he had a pattern of violent behavior throughout his entire life. And going unchecked, it's going to keep escalating until some sort of firmer guardrails of some sort are put into place. And this is not any way ever victim blaming in this at all, because hindsight is always 20/20 when things go sideways, because we never in a million years do we ever expect we're going to die, and never in a million years do we ever expect someone in our life is going to be the cause of that death. And so it's very hard to predict these things.
It's also hard for when a child of say that the age that we're going to go for is 11. If the child is showing violent tendencies, is having these uncontrollable outbreaks and rages, the current mental health processes are not going to jump in and diagnose that as any sort of schizo or schizoaffective disorder, because that is a child. And that's part of the problem. When a child shows those aberrations that early, they don't want to label them in case it's something else. But then again, they're not getting the help if they are early onset schizoaffective or schizophrenia. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. And you know, okay. So, you know, fear of the labeling can be a part of it, like you said. I was looking at it, because I know one of the other questions that we had was, what could they have done? What could be done differently? What kind of parenting style did they use? That kind of thing. There's really, and to your point, Lisa, there's not a lot, you know, you can use a firmer, more controlled environment. I actually looked it up. I'll look it up again in a second. I have in my notes. But outside of that, because like even the conservatorship, we've covered this before on a show, the conservatorship where someone is actually in control of his life and you can actually put someone away for their own safety and well-being is extremely limited by the law about how long you can do that for. It's like literally just days. And if you're doing all the things that are expected, like going to rehab, what is it, 8 times, 9 times? Again, I'm just going off the top of my head. It was up there in numbers. You're playing the game. You're playing the system. And when you have compassionate, empathetic parents that are loving and caring and not wanting to, because basically, I mean, Nick trauma bonded them to him. You know, it's like they became afraid of confrontation because you don't want it to get worse. And so you get into that method of not being too firm because you're afraid of where it could go. And so you're trying to manage that you're trying to manage chaos is what you're trying to do. And so, yeah, but I'm with you on the system definitely keeps failing on the mental health issues.
It really does. And this is not something against the parents, but like you, to what you mentioned, they can be try to be firm, but then they see what is just heartbreaking. Let's mm-hmm. say I'm going to use a little bit of a personal allegory here. My son had some mental health problems and had to go to the hospital for a little while because his medication was completely off the charts, and he was having some delusions and some hallucinations. It was all med-based, but we were honestly scared at the beginning that it was early onset schizophrenia. Thank goodness it wasn't. But what I'm saying is it takes that time of completely taking off medication when there's problems like this and figuring out exactly what is the problem. And a lot of people can't stop and do that. And let me tell you, it was hard to see my 12-year-old son completely sedated out of his mind at the first part of it as they're pulling him off of everything. It's very hard to see, and you don't want to see it. So you're like, I'm going to take them home. I can do this. We can do this at home. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, and Lisa, you bring up a really good point there that struck me as you're saying this. You had a hard time doing this because it's your son. Yes. This is why I talk about the concept of loving critic so often. And you guys met my loving critic at Tony's wedding, my wife.
And we love her, by the way. We have to say she's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, she makes me a better person. Well, we make each other better people because that's what happens. And so because we ourselves are so close to a problem sometimes, we can't be objective for ourselves. That's why we need a loving critic to be our one who cares about us, but not the outcome we seek. And so my wife for me, when I get too vested in something, I have an emotional outcome of what I'm trying to achieve. She's my loving critic. She gives me objectivity because she has deep love and caring for me. What happens in families also, I mean, imagine this. You need a family because Lisa, you gave a great example of you are so emotionally vested in your son. You're overwhelmed by the situation. You're scared by the situation. You're fearful of labels, meanings, because you're so close. You couldn't be your own loving critic in that moment. So what helps people, both you and then in the Reiner's case, is for them not to make the decisions. They're the ultimate decision maker. But having a loving critic, a loving family, counselors, whatever it is, someone you trust that is vested in your success but not the outcome you seek, that can be that loving critic to say, listen, this is going a little bit sideways. You need to do this specifically of Nick. Or in your case, say, listen, it's going to be okay, Lisa. It's just medication. Calm down. Don't worry about it. You know, so that's why we have professionals and medicine and all that. But a lot of times those aren't enough because you don't feel they're vested enough in you, your family, how much they care. That's why the healthier, stronger relationships we have with each other in relationships, the better it can be. And that's why, you know, I'm digressing in this, but that's why we have the great team here at True Crime Today, you know, and Hidden Killers, because we were all so vested in each other because we care deeply so that we can be each other's. And we do. That's why we check in with each other. Here's what's going on. Here's what we think about this. What do you want to do about this? Tony's out. Oh my God, we're going to freak out. Tony's away. So all these things, because we're constantly doing it for each other. So when things go sideways in our other parts of lives, realize, all right, I'm too close to this problem. I need a loving critic part of my life for this.
Moving on to a question from Ray. He slapped this on our YouTube comments. He says, they fought at a party hours before the murders and everyone just went home. What does that say when people around them had apparently grown used to this behavior? Robin?
Yeah, they got normalized.
Yeah.
And that also shows that this wasn't an isolated behavior. It shows that it was an escalating pattern over time. It became, not that they thought it was okay, but it became accepted and normalized because Nick had normalized it, and his parents bringing him to places must have normalized it as well. So you have a part, and I'm not going to completely blame it all on that, or not blame it, rationalize it on that. It's also fear of taking action, because you don't want to be the one person to call. And that's why we have, and we covered on one of the shows, Todd, you put up the number of the violence, not the violence prevention hotline. Is it
domestic something?
Yeah, it's the one I'm a spokesman for now. I'm trying not to confuse it with the violence prevention hotline. But it's like that. So if you think there's a threat of impending violence against someone or something, and you're a third party and you're afraid to make a move and you're afraid to call law enforcement, you're afraid to confront someone, you call the hotline, because they can actually help you, as they're trained counselors on those hotlines and trained operators to actually work through that with you. That's one of these cases that could help that a lot. But I'm not blaming anyone at this party, but at the same time though, that's a moment where loving critics in the Reiner's family could have stepped in, and or could have hopefully have done something and say, listen, Rob, that was a little unleashed what we saw tonight. What's going on? Are you safe tonight? Now, granted, would they probably say, yeah, we're fine. He probably does this all the time, you know, kind of thing. So could that have happened? Yeah. But, and who knows? We'll only know when he goes to trial. That could have happened as well, because man, people, families, when you're that close, I mean, can you imagine the Reiners, who love their son so much that they're willing to put up with so much? Even if one of these people from that party said, I fear for your life, Rob and Michelle, you need to do something. You can imagine them saying, we got it. Correct?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
100%.
It's a hard place to be.
And I think it's even harder in this, you know, I'm not trying to you know, make them out to be more than they are, but in Los Angeles and California and Hollywood, I think the last thing you want to do as is draw attention to something, right? Because you don't want it to be out in the press and stuff like that. So that may have hindered some of their loving critics from making phone calls or really saying, hey, Rob and Michelle, you got to do something about this. People may have, you know, had hands off a little bit more because they're from California, because they're in Hollywood and in that whole thing. I can't imagine knowing that this was going on in the family and maybe not being able to do much about it just because of the line of work you're in.
And think about this. It makes complete sense too. So here's Rob and Michelle, extremely successful. And it's not like this has been unknown and a spike. They gave the appearance of, well, we've been dealing with it a long time. They've obviously have it handled for this long. It's a horrendous situation. It's tough on it, but it's them. They know what they're doing. They're successful. They must have the right answers. And so people also defer to a position of authority, title, position, all that also plays in, because it's never just one thing. It's always a conglomeration of many that play into these things. And I think that definitely came to play. So imagine this. If it had been someone that didn't have that same title and position, say it was one of us with one of our kids, the likelihood of someone having the courage without a title and position to intervene in our family, if we saw that same behavior, can you imagine it being more or less?
I don't know if it would be more or less, but I would think it would be about the same. I don't know if I could step up and get into somebody's family's business, although Lisa might disagree with that because we're so close.
I've heard you. I don't know.
I was just going to say, oh, Todd, you know, you'll get up in somebody's business. But think about, though, if it's not like your uber close friends, you're just in a situation where you see this kind of thing happening, say at your neighbor's house, and you're noticing the escalation. We're in the society where it's like, I'm sorry, not my circus, not my monkeys. Right. You know, we're all looking the other way.
Yeah, that definitely comes into play as well. Anyway,
got another one more question on this topic, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Here's a good one. Everyone's whispering insanity defense. All right. But the burden of proof is on him to prove it, not the state to disprove it. Does that seem backwards to anyone else? And I'll make a very quick response here. No. Like, I think if you're going to go for an insanity defense, I really feel like that should be up to the defense side to try and prove that. I don't think it should have to be disproved. That's just an opinion, though.
Yeah, and I agree. The level required for insanity defense is extremely high. And the, you know, I'm not a licensed psychologist or clinician, so I always want to caveat things like that. But the level of testing needed to be done is really, really high. I looked this up, by the way, so I just want to double check my stats on it. I think, what was it? It's like only 2-3% of attempts for not guilty by reason of insanity as a defense is like 2-3%. It is really, really low.
Yeah.
To be able to claim it, because the bar for reaching that, I remember from growing up, used to hear that a lot more, where people are kind of excusing really, really, really important behavior because they got a broken brain. I think people really got smart to that because people were taking advantage of the mental health system, which is in shambles, but it's not nearly like it was anymore. Let me see if I can find that actual number. Success. Okay, here it is. Challenges in practice. Success rate is low nationwide, and in California, historically, under 1% of cases result in not guilty by reason of insanity, and many resolved by plea deals rather than full trials. Prosecutors often vigorously oppose it, especially in high-profile violent cases like this. Voluntary intoxication, drugs, alcohol generally does not qualify, and in this case, he'd have to go through a lot more testing. His documented history of schizophrenic disorder, medication changes, and reported delusions, knowing he killed his parents but not grasping why he's in jail or seeing it as a conspiracy, could be central to their argument, but it would hinge on expert testimony about his exact mental state on December 14th. But it has no formal plea deal has been entered publicly on this case or not regarding that. So it's a lot of testing, a lot of proving that he was unaware, because it comes down to, do they know right from wrong? Do they know the consequences of the action? And him being that functional and not institutionalized, and
But was he functional, and should he have been institutionalized? That's where my question is.
Yeah, and then that's going to come down to those expert clinicians and what they say about it. So if you're out, and I know functional is a strange word to many people, because you have functional alcoholics, you have functional drug addicts, and you have functional this. I think it's going to be a real stretch for them to be able to claim insanity on this one. I really, really do. Because it's the thing about this. It's not like he now should have been institutionalized is one thing, but the fact that he wasn't and existing in the world, maneuvering around the world, granted, there's a lot of really bad, abhorrent people that are just assholes that you know, would not be able to claim insanity either. They're just really bad people you don't want to be around, and he's one of them. So I think they're going to have a really hard stretch doing it, because again, the stats on being able to claim it, I mean, just think about this. Lori Daybell Vallow was unable to get that, you know, and she murdered her kids because she said they're possessed by evil demons. I mean, we've covered cases that I think are even higher on the Nutter scale than this one, or at least on par with it, and that they haven't even been able to try. So I doubt if they're going to be able to get it.
And here's a question that's probably better for Bob, like tomorrow or sometime, but doesn't, when you plead not guilty by reason of insanity, or aren't you actually pleading guilty but insane? I mean, you're actually admitting something. I did something, but I was not in my right mind at doing it.
Yeah, that's a good legal question for Bob. Yeah,
get him on the phone. Is Bob on the phone? Call
Bob. Get Bob on the phone.
Maybe, or Eric Faddis as well. That's a good question. I don't know, because again, we haven't come across one of our cases yet that we've covered that actually it's been a defense. So think about that too. You know, I've been doing this with Tony like 4 years now, and out of all the cases we've covered, we have not covered one that actually came to that bar. So this being the first one, it's hard to stretch a thing it would be, but I don't know the consequence of that anyway. Anyway, what are your questions? Put them in the comment sections of YouTube and Substack, or message us on Facebook and Instagram. The links are in the description. Last case, And this one is really, this is through the Rex Heuermann case, really asunder for me. Anyway, Rex Heuermann spent 17 years hiding in plain sight, married, working as an architect in Manhattan, living a few miles from where he dumped the bodies. Then in April, he pleaded guilty to 8 murders in one flat, emotionless afternoon. And in June, a judge gave him 3 life sentences plus 100 years and told him to his face he was a coward. He's sitting in Clinton Correctional now, agreeing to sit down with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. And while at least one victim known as only Asian Doe still doesn't have her name back, and that's the question that keeps landing in the inbox. If it took 3 decades and this much luck to catch one man, how many more Rex Heuermanns are out there right now banking on the same thing he did? Nobody would look too hard for the women he chose. Anyway, also with this too, I definitely want to go down the road of the therapist, because that's amazing to me. Anyway, what do you all
think? That's where a lot of the questions are coming in, because if the therapist isn't licensed and any of that she presented to courts or whatever, does all of that now fruit of the poison tree? Does it have to be tossed? She wasn't licensed. Is anything like that? I mean, does this set him up for an appeal that'll get him out of a guilty plea?
No, we asked Derek that on Thursday. He said no.
Okay.
Lisa, you were so on. As I asked that same question of Eric, our prosecutor and defense attorney, because I was like, I was worried that might overturn things or give them grounds for appeal. No, it does not. So I did a deeper dive on how could this possibly happen, and it's actually incumbent upon the Correctional Institute and their mental health unit to actually do the verifications of anyone coming in there as a therapist to work with clients. And also it's on the lawyer that actually did the recommendation as well to do the due diligence, and no one did that due diligence. But I want to hit on something here that's been really interesting on this one to me. This to me, so I'm going to start my little weekly thing I was telling Todd about of doing on our show on Mondays, the weekly behavioral wobble or the tempo tell, as I call them. This therapist gave me the wobble, gave us all the wobble, and it gave us a wobble in 2 areas. One, Asa living in the bedroom of the murderer after the remodel. You know, we're all of us, and we asked Siobhan, you know, our amazing psychotherapist on Wednesdays, what's going on with that? What therapist would recommend this? And now, to Siobhan's great credit, you know, she's given a lot of grace to the therapist, because this is, you know, you can't tell the client what to do or not to do, kind of help guide them towards their healing, which was really spot on. But it was still the fact that Asa's living in that room was a wobble to me. I'll tell you what the biggest wobble before that happened was just watching the Peacock special. I'm looking at this therapist spilling her guts about her clients. And I remember asking Siobhan about this as well. What therapist would actually spill their guts so much on TV about their clients, both of them, about what's going on? So again, when you see a wobble like that, and I don't know for a fact, but I think that's what drew the attention for people to do this deep dive and find out, oh, you're a fraud. Because you had 2 big wobbles going on there. Because when we see the wobbles, doesn't mean something's right or wrong. It attracts our attention. Those behaviors would attract my attention.
It's interesting that you mentioned what therapist would be talking about their clients in a situation like that, because I would think that all of that would fall under HIPAA. And even if you did sign away your privacy rights, I think that's definitely a problematic.
I imagine that it's the other therapists out there that saw that, and regardless of the fact that you signed it away, the fact that they did that anyway. Because again, what's the intent? You always look at intent. What was her intent about going on Peacock and speaking? So it wasn't like she's in the background. She took a front row seat of this. So that was definitely profitable for her to do it until it was too much and it was exposed. Todd, you're about to say something?
Well, yeah, and just because they signed the HIPAA release, I guess my question would be, would a therapist who's a good therapist and has some, and just my thoughts, has some morals, would they actually do that? When this first came out, one of the first things I thought of is she going to write a book? Is she going to try and profit off this whole horrible story and the information that she learned about Rex Heuermann behind closed doors. It was the first thing that came to mind.
I'm not saying that ethics are, you know, getting close to being extinct, but I think that's exactly what you're talking about. The ethics just aren't there. And that's happening in a lot of professions. Mm. I hate to say it, but still, I think this is completely an ethical question.
Absolutely. Like court clerks in a Murdoch case.
Yes.
Exactly like that case. Yes.
You know, greed does amazing, horrendous things to human beings. You know, we get caught up in the cult of more and the disease of comparison, and we do horrendous things that are contrary to all things with morals and ethics as a species. And when we sit back and we're watching the show of their lives do these things, it's befuddling. But again, I got a theme today. The theme is loving critic. I had it with Becky Hill, you know, in Murdoch case. Like, what loving critic in Becky Hill's case, in a Murdoch case, her as a court clerk, said it was a great idea to write a book during the case.
Yeah.
And I mean, who does that? And then in this case too, what loving critic, in other words, who does she have a close enough relationship to her in her life that she's sharing what she's doing and they say, that's a great idea. Do all this unlicensed. That's a fan. Oh, you want to go on Peacock and talk about this case and you're unlicensed? That's a great idea too. Do that. In other words, anytime I was going to do something big in my career, whether it was, you know, had to do, usually is operationally in some way. I've said it before on the show. I was a type of operator in the world of counterintelligence. I love pushing the bounds of what we were allowed to, never legal, but we had policies, and I'd always be right on that edge pushing because policies kept us from doing, in my opinion, the great righteous work. And my wife would always ask me these questions, the simplest question ever. Before I wanted to take an action on something where I was pushing that bound, she always said, so did you tell Steve? Steve was my supervisor. And I say, well, and he goes, well, if you're not comfortable telling Steve, then you shouldn't be doing it. In other words, the test of transparency, and that is the greatest test of whether we should or shouldn't be doing something. If you can't be completely honest and transparent of what you're doing and everything that's going on, you probably shouldn't be doing it. And in this case, think about this. If she was transparent in the fact that she wasn't licensed, would any of this have happened?
Probably not, right?
Then why'd you do it?
That's why I bring up the whole book thing or making some money off of it. Good question here to start with. The victim's family said flat out their daughters weren't taken seriously for years because of the work they did. That's on law enforcement as much as it is on Rex. And that's from Karen on Facebook. I just want to mention this. After listening to Bob Mata's podcast on John Wayne Gacy, buried inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation, there's a lot of similarities here with police officers, law enforcement, and wanting to kind of sweep things under the carpet because the victims were not bankers or socially acceptable in the community and all that stuff. So in this case, we had sex workers in John Wayne Gacy. We had primarily young men who were gay. There's a lot of similarities here. And I wonder how much responsibility does fall on the law enforcement folks in the Rex Heuermann story.
That is a really tough area. It's a heartbreaking area too. I've covered these cases. I've been part of a few task forces that were trying to address this out in LA, believe it or not. I remember years ago, I was out in LA working with, California Highway Patrol. It was California Highway Patrol. And they were trying to up their number of pimps they were trying to put away. In order to put away these horrendous human beings that were trafficking women, you had to have the women willing to testify and share with you the horrendous life that they're being forced to live. And the fear factor they had of law enforcement locking them up was also a thing they had overcome. And they didn't have, because of the pressures they were having on top, these investigators were trying their best to make these inroads with the girls to try to have them overcome their fear of sharing. Because these girls are living in complete fear. They're fearing everyone because they're being trafficked by these horrendous traffickers. They're fearing the law enforcement for locking them up and taking away. I mean, it's just nothing but fear. And so that's one problem is the fear of law enforcement, the fear of reciprocity. Then you have the other aspect of it, and so wholeheartedly what you're talking about, Todd, and that is what society disenfranchises them because of this, because there's a lack of understanding that I've never known one case that I've ever covered in my career that it was a choice. It was someone who is trafficked. I mean, just look at all the girls that got tied up in the Epstein case. Not one. If you ever watched, what's her name's book? I've read it on the Epstein case.
Gazelle.
Yeah. Guffrey. Jenny. Guffrey.
Yep.
Not one of those girls ever made a choice to do this. They were totally trafficked into this lifestyle, and so that is the one aspect of the surrender side. Then you actually have the law enforcement side of. We've covered this before too. So here I am. I'm an investigator. I have in front of me upwards of almost 100 cases. And when I was at headquarters and I had all these cases, and even as a field agent, I had all these cases, the squeaky wheel got the oil. And the squeaky wheel is who's going to call in, what boss is going to call me, what parents are going to call me, what victims are going to call me and nag the living hell out of me righteously. It's not that any case was more important than another. You try to take them sequentially as they come in. And what happens is that they get reshuffled and reprioritized by people above you, by families, because you're yanked all these different ways because your own emotional compulsion want to do these things, but then you're yanked another way. In other words, there's never enough law enforcement officers and investigators to cover all the cases. And so they're going to cover the ones that are getting a lot of the noise. And so that's a horrendous aspect of it. There's no right answer to this, except they just need more people to do this. And just save girls from trafficking in the first place. We got to focus on the trafficking aspect hugely, because that is such, if you just take out the root cause, then all these other things just start fixing themselves. And being anti-child trafficking and it's slavery. It's literally international slavery, because a lot of these things are even happening. They come to our country internationally. I mean, just the work I did with Innocent Lives Foundation really brought a lot of that to light for me as well.
I have to say that is probably the best description of what goes through a law enforcement officer's mind when they're sitting there with those cases. So I want to thank you for that, Robin, because you think about, you have, as you said, 100 cases in front of you. The one you're going to be working on is that one with that squeaky wheel. And unfortunately, some of the people who are on the fringes of society don't have somebody being that squeaky wheel for them.
Lisa, thanks for that. I mean, I get really misty talking about this because I guarantee you this, these law enforcement officers are going to go to save these girls. And they learn how to work and argue to be allowed to do that work. And they're then being told they can do that work. Like, I'm going to go on the glass half full on this. But then it gets down to the next challenge. It goes back to that first challenge I talked about, is how do you inspire these girls to share? Because if they're not willing to testify and put their lives potentially in danger, if they don't get a conviction, they could die. And they live in that kind of fear. And so what happens is I told these guys, the state troopers, I said, unfortunately, the thing you need to do in order to do this effectively is you need time and patience, because you need to establish that these girls can trust you over a period of time at a tempo that they feel comfortable in doing it. You need to develop a relationship. And they said, I totally get it. But the boss says, if we don't get a result in a collar and an arrest at this timeline, we got to move on. And so you have this incongruency between what we can get, because again, what's that come down to? Why the boss is doing that? It's not that the bosses are insensitive. In order to get the grants and the funding, they have to be able to show the stats. If you can't get the stats because you actually can't develop the relationships in a time that the stats say you need the relationship in order to get the funding for the grant and get the, see what I mean? Yeah. This is such a horrendous system, but that's what actually, as Bob says, the sausage, how it's made behind the scenes. It's not that I've known some, remember, you don't go into, again, there's bad apples out there. I luckily never worked with any. Law enforcement and first responders and people in this line of work don't do it to make a living and become rich. off the government's dime. You can't. Yeah. I mean, you do it because you care so deeply about human beings and you're doing your best to save them. And so when you care so deeply about human beings, what are the ones you're doing? You want to save the ones most disenfranchised. But the system can become really cumbersome to work with. And that's why the senior guys, holding on to senior guys is so important too, because they understand how to work that system. I mean, by the end of my career, dude, I knew our system down. Anyway, I digress.
We got time for one more question on this, and we'll make it real quick before we wrap up. This is from Tom on Facebook. Families in that courtroom straight up said they think they're more victims that he hasn't been charged with. If that's true, does closure even mean anything here?
I'm agreeing on this. I think there are more victims. I mean, we've said this before too. His only human's only currency he has left in life is information. And there's no way in living hell a psychopathic, narcissistic, self-serving, sadistic ass like him is going to give up all his information at that. He's holding on to it to dole out as he wants the next thing, as he wants that criminal notoriety, as he wants that grandiosity to see how great he is so he can have the BAU interview him and be part of some great study. There's no way he's given it all up. I don't think it at all. And so will there ever be closure for anyone? There'll be closure for some, I think, in years, but never enough because there's so many victims out there still. And now, I mean, just think about this. All the ones that had daughters that are still missing and they live in either that part of New York or the Carolinas or in Vegas that he traveled to and his family had vacations in, they're always, if they have a daughter that went missing, will there ever be closure, you know, for them on that? It's a long, tough road for those families. I give my thoughts, prayers, and hugs to them as they struggle through that.
Lisa, I'm going to give you one last word on this, and then we'll wrap up the show.
I don't know how I could top anything that Robin did today.
I know. Honestly. Sorry for putting you in that position. But.
You put me in the position to try to top. No, it's not happening. But no, I think this has been a very interesting discussion in that we've taken a couple of different tacks this morning, and I'm glad we did this.
Yeah.
You're all very kind as we feel. Thank God for the last day.
Listen, you've done a great job today, Robin. Nice job.
And you're great.
And how the sausage is made, so everyone that's tuning in just know I'm actually working off of a new teleprompter today. I bought a new camera because I felt so bad the other day. I didn't do as good as Tony does. So I literally bought new equipment over the weekend, trying to tweak it and anything. Anyway, all that being said, that's a wrap for today's show. Tomorrow, Tony is back from his honeymoon. Make sure to hit like and follow Hidden Killers wherever you get your podcast. For Todd, Lisa, and myself, have a great day, and we'll see you tomorrow at 11 Central for Hidden Killers Live.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.